This is VOA News. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. A Ukrainian court Monday sentenced a Russian soldier to life in prison for killing an unarmed Ukrainian civilian in the northeastern village of Sumy. The 21-year-old soldier, Sergeant Vadim Shishmarin, had previously pleaded guilty, telling the court he acted after an officer told him to shoot the man. Reporter Anna Chernikova in Kyiv told VOA the details of the case.
A court in Kyiv handed down the first conviction of a war crime. Russian serviceman Vadim Shishmarin was accused of killing a civilian in Sumy region, and he was sentenced to life in prison. I should say that since February 24, almost the entire Ukrainian law enforcement system has been investigating Russian war crimes. And this one is a very special case because this is the first case, and it demonstrates, you know, this Ukrainian war for independence very well, showing, you know, how civilians in the Sumy region were also involved, helping to catch these Russian soldiers. The court found evidence against Shishmarin and concluded that the murder was premeditated. The court rejected the defense's arguments that Shishmarin had allegedly carried out the order because it was given by a military man who was not Shishmarin's commander, and the order itself was criminal.
The Starbucks coffee chain, meanwhile, Monday announced it is pulling completely out of Russia. The company had suspended all business activity in Russia as of March 8th. But in a statement posted to its website Monday, Starbucks said it had made the decision to exit and no longer have a brand presence in the Russian market. The statement said the company would continue to support the nearly 2,000 Starbucks employees it has in Russia, including providing 6 months' pay and assistance for the employees to transition to other opportunities. This is VOA News. In Tokyo Monday, U.S. President Joe Biden announced the launch of the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, or IPEF, which includes a dozen Indo-Pacific countries and is designed to provide a counterweight against Chinese economic clout in the region. Speaking during the launch of the IPEF event, Biden said the future of the 21st century economy is going to largely be written in the Indo-Pacific, in our region, Biden said, and we are writing the new rules. The countries joining the launch are Australia, Brunei, India, Indonesia, Japan, South Korea, Malaysia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Singapore, Thailand, and Vietnam. Biden was joined in the launch in person by Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Leaders from the other nations joined in virtually. The IPEF is seen as a key step in the U.S. effort to re-engage Indo-Pacific nations on trade more than 5 years after the U.S. withdrawal from a regional comprehensive trade pact, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, better known as the TPP. At the World Food Program chief says that the is pressing billionaires to step up during the Davos, the World Economic Forum in Davos. A Associated Press correspondent Charles DeLadesma reports.
Bill Beasley is telling billionaires to prove their worth as the global threat of food insecurity rises with Russia's war in Ukraine, adding he's seeing encouraging signs from some of the world's richest people, like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos. Musk, the world's richest man, has donated about 5 million shares of company stock worth roughly $5.7 billion to an unidentified charity in November. Beasley adds, "The world's in real serious trouble. This is not rhetoric. Step up now, because the world needs you." I'm Charles de Ledesma.
A report released Monday shows U.S. consumers are using their existing vehicles longer than ever before, as the inventory of new cars and light trucks remains constrained due to supply chain challenges. The report, compiled by the firm Standard & Poor Global Mobility, shows the average age of light vehicles in operation in the U.S. rose to 12.2 years this year, increasing by nearly 2 months from the previous year. The report said the pandemic drove consumers to shift from using public transportation and shared transportation to personal cars, and since consumers could not upgrade their vehicles, demand for used cars accelerated and boosted the average vehicle age. The New York Federal Reserve reported in its latest update to a worldwide index of supply problems that stress on the global supply chains worsened in April as COVID-19 lockdown measures in China and the war in Ukraine lengthened delivery times and air freight costs between the U.S. and Asia. Repeating the hour's top story, Ukrainian court Monday sentenced a Russian soldier to life in prison for killing an unarmed Ukrainian civilian. Reporting via remote, I'm Jeff Custer. This
Today is Monday, May 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russia presses offensive in eastern Ukraine after claiming victory in Mariupol.
Moscow launched what appeared to be a major assault to seize the last Ukrainian-held territory in Luhansk, part of the southeastern Donbas.
U.S. President Joe Biden set to launch Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity after a visit to Seoul.
And work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
And indiscriminate bombings pushed the number of displaced civilians in Myanmar to nearly a million. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Russia pressed its offensive in eastern Ukraine on Sunday after claiming victory in Mariupol, ending the bloodiest siege of the Ukrainian war so far. Kremlin forces launched artillery and missile attacks in the region known as Donbas, seeking to expand the territory that Moscow-backed separatists have held since 2014. In an escalation of a battle over energy pricing, Moscow stopped gas supplies to Finland. Lucy Fielder of Reuters has more.
The last Ukrainian forces holed up in Azovstal surrendered on Friday, Russia's defense ministry said, ending the bloodiest siege of the war. They were seen arriving on buses in the Russian-controlled town of Olenivka near Donetsk. Ukraine's general staff of armed forces did not comment on Russia's claim in its morning update. Meanwhile, Moscow launched what appeared to be a major assault to seize the last Ukrainian-held territory in Luhansk, part of the southeastern Donbas. Russian-backed separatists already controlled swathes of territory there before the February 24th invasion. Luhansk's regional governor said on social media early on Saturday that Russia was trying to destroy the city of Severodonetsk, with fighting taking place on its outskirts. The end of fighting in Mariupol, the biggest city Russia has captured so far and the main port for the Donbas, gives Russian President Vladimir Putin a rare victory after a series of setbacks. Putin says Russian troops are undertaking a special military operation to demilitarize Ukraine and rid it of radical anti-Russian nationalists. Western countries call it an unprovoked war of aggression. Moscow also halted gas exports to Finland on Saturday in an escalation of an energy payment dispute with Western nations. It had rejected Russian demands to pay for the gas in rubles because of Western sanctions. The move comes days after Finland and Sweden applied to join NATO, a decision spurred by the Ukraine war.
That's Lucy Fielder of Reuters. U.S. President Joe Biden will launch in Tokyo on Monday a long-awaited Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity. The program is intended to bind regional countries more closely via common standards in areas including supply chain resilience, clean energy, infrastructure, and digital trade. While in Seoul, Biden and South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol signed a stronger military posture amid a series of recent North Korean missile test launches. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wheeler-Skuwara is traveling with the president and brings this report.
As North Korea aims to accelerate development of its nuclear arsenal, neighboring South Korea, a close U.S. ally, wants to strengthen its defenses.
On the ever-increasing nuclear and missile threats from North Korea, I and President Biden shared serious concerns and agreed on the need to prioritize them over any other issue.
In a news conference with newly inaugurated President Yoon Suk-yeol in Seoul, President Joe Biden agreed to discuss expanding military exercises with South Korea.
And work together to take on challenges of regional security, including addressing the threat posed by the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, by further strengthening our deterrence posture and working toward a complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula.
Military exercises between the allies were scaled back during the pandemic and as part of the efforts by the previous Trump administration to engage North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Yet North Korea continues its weapons programs with 16 missile tests this year alone. U.S. officials have warned that Pyongyang may conduct additional missile or even nuclear tests while Biden is in Asia. Both leaders also expressed concern over the recent COVID-19 outbreak in North Korea and say they are in discussions with China to look for ways to help Pyongyang that so far has refused vaccine donations. On Friday, Biden and Yoon toured the Samsung Pyeongtaek campus, the world's largest semiconductor plant and a model for a 17 billion computer chip facility Samsung is building outside Austin, Texas. In the week ahead in Tokyo, Biden is scheduled to launch the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, IPEF. IPEF is a centerpiece of U.S. economic policy in the region since the Trump administration's 2017 withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the free trade agreement the Obama administration launched in 2016. It is still unclear whether Seoul will sign on to IPEF that has been criticized for its lack of market access provisions, making it less attractive than existing regional free trade agreements. Patsy Vidakuswara, VOA News, Seoul.
In Myanmar, airstrikes and indiscriminate bombings have intensified, pushing the total number of displaced people to nearly a million. Civilians who have recently fled their homes in Kayin State speak out about the dangers of returning to work in their fields ahead of the next growing season. This as battles between Myanmar's army and opposition forces draw the conflict closer to civilian targets. Steve Sanford reports from Upang, Thailand.
In Myanmar's Kayin State, many farmers and their families are afraid to return home to plant seasonal crops as aerial attacks intensify. As junta forces face increased resistance by opposition troops on the ground, they have turned to brutal attacks from above, creating fear and panic for the villagers. Reporting by the Free Burma Rangers, a relief organization, of junta attacks on civilian locations has shown what rights groups say amounts to attacks intentionally directed against civilians. Collecting evidence has come at a cost for the multi-ethnic aid group, formed by ex-U.S. Special Forces veteran and former missionary David Eubanks in 1997.
We see the biggest fighting since World War II going on in Burma. Attacks almost every area of Burma, over a million internally displaced. That's newly internally. So the biggest thing people need is someone to stop the Burma army from attacking and bombing them, strafing with airplanes, helicopters, armored vehicles, mortars, machine gun, artillery. We saw all of it. In fact, 10 of our Rangers have died since the coup, which is about 10 times a normal year for our relief work. It's terrible.
In addition to the airstrikes, the reported increased use of landmines has further restricted access to farmland for many. For workers like Na So, whose land is now a war zone, the reduced income and food supply is devastating for her family.
Some of the landmines that soldiers planted have exploded, while some didn't. Bullets shot from the jets landed on the farmland. Karen soldiers were able to remove some landmines that weren't planted too deep and took them out of the farm to destroy them.
Despite the fighting, for some, the work must go on at any cost. Steve Sanford for VOA News in Umpang, Thailand.
In other news, the head of the World Health Organization has warned that the COVID-19 pandemic is, quote, most certainly not over, unquote, despite a decline in reported cases since the peak of the Omicron wave. He told governments on Sunday that, quote, we lower our guards at our peril, unquote. The UN Health Agency's Director General told officials gathered in Geneva for the opening of the WHO annual meeting that, quote, declining testing and sequencing means we are binding ourselves to the evolution of the virus, unquote. The WHO leader noted that almost 1 billion people in lower-income countries still haven't been vaccinated and said vaccine hesitancy around the world has been fueled by, quote, disinformation, unquote. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Pakistan is seeking closer economic and diplomatic ties with the United States after years of strained relations under former Prime Minister Imran Khan. New Foreign Minister Bilawal Bhutto Zardari has already reached out to U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken. Bhutto Zardari, the 33-year-old son of assassinated Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto, called the talks with Blinken, quote, very encouraging and very positive and productive, unquote. But his task has been complicated following growing tensions with Khan, who has pledged to lead a massive rally this week that officials fear will cripple activities in the capital city. Khan accused the Biden administration of colluding with the opposition to oust him, a claim the administration denies. For more, I spoke with VOA's Ayaz Gaul.
On sort of on a mission to try to repair according to them, that relationship. But let me just tell you, the situation in Pakistan on the ground is very challenging for this new united government or coalition government led by Shehbaz Sharif, is that they are facing a strong opposition from the ousted Prime Minister Imran Khan, who has held major, huge rallies across Pakistan and demanding new elections because he has rejected the no confidence vote against him in parliament as illegal. And the latest development was that former Prime Minister announced that he is going to lead a massive anti-government march on Wednesday on the national capital, Islamabad, and has vowed to stage a sit-in protest in the capital city with tens of thousands of Pakistanis until his demand for early election is met. So this political crisis and then economic crisis that the new government is trying to fix have kept the government so much busy that at this moment, relationship seems not a priority for the new government. It is the survival of this government. Whether this government survives, that is the main question. The foreign policy matters as of today are of secondary nature.
Won't improved ties with Washington help in solving or at least ameliorating some of the economic difficulties and challenges this new government is facing?
Yes, that is definitely what it wants, because improved relationship with Washington means there will be more concessions from the International Monetary Fund, because this new government has already been negotiating a bailout package to deal with this economic crisis. But as I said, that the issue is that whether this government enjoys the public support that would give confidence to international lending agencies, including IMF and World Bank, to deal with this government some kind of a bailout package. And even Washington, I think, must be right now watching to see whether this government is able to deal with this serious crisis, because which is not reflected in the media. But what is happening in Pakistan, that Imran Khan has gathered tens of thousands of people, and the worry is Islamabad is not that big a city. If he manages to bring this huge crowd to Islamabad, and as he has promised that he's going to stage a sit-in protest for as long as it is needed, we are foreseeing a sort of a crippling, life crippling in and around the city and maybe generally in Pakistan later this week. So I think that political crisis will determine the fate of this government, and that's when obviously, once they successfully deal with this political crisis and do not budge or come under pressure, then that will be the time, I think, countries like the United States and other in the West would try to engage with the new government. This country is almost on the verge of default if it does not come up with some urgent and quick remedies to fix the economic challenges.
What sort of steps should Pakistan be taking to get this much needed support with Washington that the former Prime Minister Imran Khan did not?
At this moment, what is important for Pakistan and the United States to move their relationship forward is to whether Pakistan provides support to the Washington-led efforts which has invaded Ukraine. But Pakistan is one of those countries which under former Prime Minister Imran Khan voted against the U.S. Proposed resolutions on Russia's invasion against Ukraine. So whether Pakistan under this new government is able to reverse that policy and throw its weight behind Western countries to condemn the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that would be the key for the administration and for the current Pakistani government to move forward.
That's VOA's Ayaz Gao speaking with me from Islamabad. In the Philippines, teachers have mixed reactions to the possible appointment of the daughter of incumbent President Rodrigo Duterte and Vice President frontrunner Sara Duterte as Secretary of Education in the next administration. From Manila, Stanley Boate Gayate has this look at the concerns of teachers.
Filipino teachers are now torn over whether they support the possible appointment of Vice Presidential frontrunner Sara Duterte as Secretary of the Department of Education. The presumptive winner of the recent election, Ferdinand Bongbong Marcos Jr., wants Duterte to lead the department despite her desire to be defense chief. It's a role supporters say she's suited for because of what some describe her iron fist personality, a character trait also attributed to her father, the outgoing president. Attorney Vic Rodriguez, a spokesperson for the incoming president, explains the reasons why Marcos wants to name her as the head of the Department of Education.
Is she qualified? Definitely, she's a lawyer. And the biggest qualification, I think it's indisputable. She has the confidence of the 31 million Filipinos who voted her into office. As to her competence, let's give her a chance to prove that she's able to, that she can run ably the Department of Education.
Some think Duterte can lead, while others believe a more qualified and an experienced person in education should be chosen. Erwin Cabasan is a high school teacher.
Meron po tayong leadership skill na tinatawag na kung saan.
Cabasan says, while Sara Duterte does not have experience in education, she can still lead because she has a strong personality, which is important in leading and managing the department. Meanwhile, another high school teacher, Noel Meneses, says the department should be led by someone with a background in education.
Sana po we request bilang guro na...
Meneses believes an official from the education sector is much preferred because there is a need for the department to be led by someone who has experience in the grounds of education sector, which is for him a true meaning of leader. Raymond Basilio is the Secretary General of Alliance of Concerned Teachers. He sees potential problems ahead.
Wala, nung siya ay mayor ng Davao.
Basilio explains that when Sara Duterte was a city mayor of Davao in Mindanao, in the southern part of the Philippines, teachers asked for help getting a local allowance. Basilio says Duterte got angry and accused them of being part of a communist rebel group. That is why Basilio does not think she's fit for the position. Basilio also adds that mandatory military training in secondary and tertiary schools recommended by Sara Duterte is not the solution to problems in education. He says the government has often named department leaders with no past experience in the sector, which is why, in his opinion, pressing problems are not being solved effectively. Among those issues are literacy rates, the performance of students, and lack of books, facilities, and equipment.
Kabahagi na ng kasaysayan yung pagkapanalo ngayon ni Bongbong.
Basilio says Bongbong Marcos' win is now history after gaining 31 million votes on May 9's national and local elections. But he says Marcos has no right to revise Philippine history and put the Marcos and Duterte families in a good light. These fears have emerged as it becomes clearer that Marcos will soon be inaugurated. Basilio adds that Marcos' family cannot deny the number of people who died under martial law in his father's administration in the 1970s. Nor can they deny the economic losses, high foreign debt, and corruption under the leadership of his father. He says it's the same with Sara Duterte. She cannot erase her father's role in extrajudicial killings in his campaign against drugs that killed thousands of innocent people. Benjo Basas is the national chairperson for the Teachers Dignity Coalition.
We would be willing to sit down with her, to talk to her, and to present our program.
Students in the Philippines lag behind Southeast Asia in terms of comprehension in math and sciences. Observers ask how Sara Duterte could improve their educational performance. So far, she has not announced any plans. For VOA News, I am Stanley Buenafegahete in Manila, Philippines.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers from the University of Florida say that for the first time in human history, they have grown plants in soil from the moon, called lunar regolith. In a university press release, the scientists see their work as a breakthrough in the exploration of the moon and space. They say their efforts provide a crucial first step that will eventually allow future moon missions to grow their own plants for food and oxygen. In a study published by Communications Biology, researchers demonstrate that plants can spring to life and grow in the lunar regolith. The study also explains how the plants biologically react to the lunar soil. For their experiments, the scientists used only 12 grams of moon soil that was collected by the Apollo 11, 12, and 17 moon missions. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday at 2105 UTC, join me, Steve Miller, as I put the latest developments into a global context with interviews and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
To all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States strongly condemns the arrests by Hong Kong authorities of 90-year-old Cardinal Joseph Zen, the former Catholic Bishop of Hong Kong and outspoken critic of the Chinese Communist Party, and three other prominent pro-democracy advocates, Margaret Ng, a lawyer and former legislator, Hoi Po Kung, a scholar and former professor, and Denise Ho, an actress and singer. The four were trustees of the now-dissolved 612 Humanitarian Relief Fund, which was established in 2019 to provide financial and legal assistance to those who participated in pro-democracy demonstrations in Hong Kong. They were falsely charged and arrested on May 11th for colluding with foreign forces and subsequently released on bail, but could face sentences of life imprisonment. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said, in arresting these veteran activists, scholars, and religious leaders under the so-called national security law, Hong Kong authorities have again demonstrated that they will pursue all means necessary to stifle dissent and undercut protected rights and freedoms. Then White House Principal Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre called on PRC and Hong Kong authorities to cease targeting Hong Kong's advocates, noting that freedom of expression is critical to prosperous and secure societies. Over the past several years, Beijing has been increasing its control over Hong Kong, arresting democracy activists, shuttering civil society groups, and forcing independent media organizations to close. The PRC has increasingly violated the fundamental freedoms of the people of Hong Kong that were guaranteed in the Basic Law and in the Sino-British Joint Declaration when control of Hong Kong was transferred from Britain to the People's Republic of China in 1997. The arrests come just days after the only Chinese Communist Party-approved candidate for the Hong Kong chief executive position, former Hong Kong security chief John Lee Kachiu, took office. After his so-called election, the foreign ministers of the G7 countries, which include Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States, published a statement expressing grave concern over the selection process for the chief executive in Hong Kong. As part of a continued assault on political pluralism and fundamental freedoms, we continue to call on China, they declared, to act in accordance with the Sino-British Joint Declaration and its other legal obligations.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.